Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be taking a look at something pretty, how should I say, weighty. Weighty and intense. And I know you're ready for it. So today's topic is the arrest and the crucifixion of Jesus.
Right.
And specifically the way that it is presented in the Gospel of Luke.
Yeah.
So this is something that you sent me a lecture. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly thorough and detailed, and there's a lot in there, and I'm so glad you sent it to me.
Thanks.
But I think that our job today is really to kind of try to boil it down to, like, the essence of, like, you know, what are the things that people should really be taking away from this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the lecture goes into so much detail from, you know, the courtyard scene with Peter's denial all the way to the, you know, kind of drama and intensity of the actual crucifixion itself.
And, right.
And when really what's so interesting about Luke's account is the specific details that he chooses to kind of spotlight the particular angle that he takes. So we're going to try to bring those into focus.
Yeah, let's jump right into it then.
Okay.
So it starts right after Jesus is arrested.
Right.
And Luke writes, then they seized him, led him away, and brought him into the high priest's house, and Peter followed at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
That at a distance gets me every time.
Right.
Because it's such a small detail, but it says so much.
Yes.
Right. Like, I mean, immediately you kind of get into Peter's head a little bit.
Absolutely. And I think Luke uses that idea of following quite often to kind of signify, you know, that idea of discipleship.
Mm-hmm.
So Peter is following, but with that at a distance, right? Mm. He is connected, but there's this fear, right? That's kind of pulling him back.
Yeah. Yeah. You can just feel that tension already.
Absolutely.
Right. And so then the scene shifts and it kind of moves us to the courtyard of the high priest's house.
Right.
And you can almost imagine, you know, a fire is going.
Mm.
It's probably a little bit chilly.
Yeah.
You know, people are standing around just kind of, you know, milling about.
Yep. It's interesting, too, because, you know, the lecture that you sent talks about how Jesus is being kind of interrogated within earshot of Peter.
Oh, wow.
So it's not like he's tucked away in a corner somewhere.
Right.
He's, you know, Peter can probably hear snippets of what's happening inside.
That makes it even tenser.
Yeah. And even more, perhaps even more poignantly, you know, Jesus might have been able to see Peter.
Oh, wow.
Right? So it just creates this incredible atmosphere for what's about to come.
Yeah. And then, of course, we get those three denials.
Yeah.
Right? So the first one comes from a servant girl who notices Peter, and she's like, this man was with him.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter immediately denies knowing Jesus, like even having any sort of personal connection with him.
Yeah. And it's that social dynamic, right? The honor and shame culture that the lecture you sent talks about, you know, to be confronted by and then deny Jesus to someone of lower social standing than you could have been particularly humiliating.
Right.
So it's not just a denial of fact, but it's also kind of a blow to Peter's own sort of, you know, status and sense of belonging.
Yeah. Okay. And then the second denial comes from another person.
Right.
This time it's a man. And he says, you also were one of them, you know, meaning one of Jesus's followers.
Yeah.
And again, Peter's like, man, I am not.
Yeah, so it shifts a little bit, right? The focus of the accusation, it's no longer just about knowing Jesus personally.
Yeah.
But now it's about being part of his group,
right?
His broader circle, his movement. And Peter's actively distancing himself, not just from the person, but from the whole group.
Yeah. And then the third denial comes about an hour later.
Right.
This time from another man.
Yeah.
Who says, certainly this man was with him, for he too was a Galilean.
Yeah.
Now they're targeting his regional identity. You know.
Yeah, his shared background with Jesus.
Yeah, and again, Peter's like, man, I do not know what you are talking about.
It's a complete disavowal multiple levels.
Yeah, it's like it's personal. It's the, you know, group association and it's his own background, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because, you know, the lecture talks about how this part of the story actually differs a little bit in some of the details from the other gospels. So, you know, in Matthew and Mark and John.
Okay.
Luke mentions a servant girl and then two men.
Mm-hmm.
Mark talks about a slave girl twice and then some bystanders.
Right.
Matthew describes a servant girl, then a different girl, and finally bystanders.
Yeah.
And then John's account is less detailed.
Wow. I never realized that.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. So I guess, I mean, it's not a contradiction or anything like that, but I guess it's just like, what is Luke trying to...
It seems like he's emphasizing something in particular, right? Yeah. And the lecturer proposes that maybe he's highlighting Peter's initial shame and being kind of identified and challenged by a young girl. right? Someone of a lower social standing and then facing two more challenges by men.
Okay, yeah.
So it adds that kind of subtle layer of humiliation to the story.
Okay, and then we get that, I mean, for me, it's just the most, you know, gut-wrenching moment in the story where it's like, and immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed and the Lord turned and looked at Peter.
Oh, man, that gaze has so much weight behind it.
It's just like, right after all those denials, it's just that moment of eye contact. Like,
yeah, and it's a confirmation of Jesus' prophecy, right? Yeah. That Peter would deny him three times before the rooster crowed. And you know, in the lecture, it talks about Peter's immediate reaction, which is he remembered the saying of the Lord. That moment of recollection is so crucial because it's that spark, right, that kind of ignites his remorse.
Yeah. And he went out and wept bitterly.
Yeah, that image of just utter shame.
It's so raw.
And regret.
Yeah.
And it's the first step towards repentance.
Right.
And I think it's something that we can all relate to in some ways, right? Mm. When we think about, you know, times when we face difficult choices.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've maybe given into, you know, fear or weakness.
Yeah, right. You know, we've all been there.
Absolutely. And the intensity of that weeping, right, that Luke describes underscores the depth of Peter's betrayal,
right,
and yet also the depth of his love for Jesus.
Yeah.
It's just a profoundly human moment.
Yeah, for sure.
And it ties back to that earlier moment in Luke's gospel, right?
Okay.
Where Jesus talks about Satan wanting to sift Peter like wheat, but that he's prayed for him.
Right.
So you know, Peter's denial, despite Jesus' support, really kind of highlights that fragility of human resolve.
Yeah.
In the face of, you know, intense pressure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So Peter, you know, has this moment of really profound shame and sorrow and regret.
Yeah.
But then we kind of move on and we see Jesus facing a different kind of torment.
Right.
The mocking by his captors.
So Luke writes, "The men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, 'Prophesy, who is it that struck you?' And they said many other things against him, blaspheming him."
Yeah, it's just horrific.
Yeah, it's brutal.
I mean, the combination of the physical violence, right? The beatings, the blindfolding, and then the cruel taunts, you know, the verbal abuse.
Yeah.
It's all designed to just completely humiliate and degrade Jesus. And the lecture you sent really emphasized how significant mocking was in that honor and shame culture of the ancient Mediterranean world.
Right.
It wasn't just casual teasing, right?
Yep.
It was a calculated and vicious attempt to just destroy someone's sense of self-worth and their standing in the community.
Yeah, so this is like really serious stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's not just like, you know, we're just going to make fun of you for a little
while. No, it's psychological warfare, right? It's meant to break you.
Yeah, wow. So next we have the trial before the Sanhedrin.
Right.
And Luke specifically mentions that this happened during the day.
Yes.
Which the lecturer was saying, you know, is kind of more in line with like what historians think about how the Sanhedrin really operated.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to some other accounts, which might suggest that it happened at night or something like that.
Right, right. It's a little bit more historically accurate, probably.
Okay. And so the Sanhedrin,
which
was like, you know, the Jewish ruling council.
Yeah, they had significant religious authority.
Right.
They could even impose the death penalty for religious offenses, like blasphemy, but under Roman occupation.
Right.
They needed the Roman governor's approval for executions, like crucifixion. So that's kind of this key power dynamic that's going on here.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And then also in Luke's gospel, there's no mention of those false witnesses that we might see in other gospels, like Mark's gospel.
Yeah.
Okay. So instead, it's very focused on these two central questions that are posed to Jesus by the Sanhedrin. Are you the Christ?
Right.
The Messiah? And are you the Son of God?
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus's responses, they seem a little bit measured.
Yeah, I can even
almost reluctant.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there's this sense of resignation almost, right?
Right. Like he knows what's coming.
Yeah, like his mind's already made up.
Right, right.
And you know, the lecturer pointed out that the Sanhedrin probably didn't have like a solid legal basis for a death sentence, based on charges that would kind of fly with the Roman authorities.
Right, right.
So they were trying to establish some kind of religious basis, like blasphemy, which they could potentially punish by stoning. under their own law, but even then they needed Roman consent.
Got it. Mm. So then this leads to the trial before Pontius Pilate.
Right.
And here the accusations change.
They do.
Right. So now they're accusing Jesus of misleading the nation, mm-hmm. of forbidding the payment of taxes to Caesar, mm-hmm. and of claiming to be a king.
Yeah, these are serious political charges that are going to get Pilate's attention.
Right.
Right? I mean, this is challenging Roman authority.
Right.
And, you know, this could have repercussions for the stability of the whole region.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to me that despite these accusations,
right.
Pilate initially is like, nay.
Yeah, his first assessment is that Jesus is innocent.
Yeah.
He finds no basis for these accusations.
Right.
You know, nothing worthy of death.
But of course, then, you know, things get complicated.
Things do get complicated.
Yeah, because he's facing all this pressure.
Right.
You know, from the Sanhedrin and the crowds and everything. And then he learns that Jesus is from Galilee.
Right.
It's like, oh, perfect.
Yeah, let's send him to Herod.
Yeah.
Who's also in Jerusalem at the time.
Right. And so then Herod is kind of excited about this.
Yeah.
Know, at first, at least.
He's hoping for a miracle.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to see Jesus perform some signs.
Right.
But Jesus refuses to answer his questions.
Right.
Or perform any miracles.
Yeah. And so Herod and his soldiers, mm-hmm. they start mocking Jesus.
Yeah. They treat him with contempt.
Yeah. Dressing him up in fancy clothes and sending him back to Pilate.
And, you know, there's this really interesting detail that the lecture points out, which is that Pilate and Herod, who had been enemies before,
really
actually become friends.
No way.
On that day.
Because of Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah, that's great.
And so both of them conclude that Jesus is innocent.
Right.
So that's a really important theme in Luke.
Okay.
This repeated affirmation of Jesus's innocence.
Okay, yeah. And also the lecturer made a really good point about how in Luke's gospel, it's really the leaders, you know, the religious and political leaders who are the ones that are pushing for this.
Yeah, it's not the general population.
Right.
It might be portrayed in some other accounts.
Right, so it's really on them.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we get to
kind
of like the moment where everything comes to a head.
Right.
You know, and Pilate is facing all this pressure from the crowd.
Right.
And he's repeatedly saying that Jesus is innocent.
Yes.
But ultimately he gives in.
Right.
You know.
It's tragic.
Yeah, he grants their request to release Barabbas, who's this guy who's in prison for insurrection and murder.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's this unsettling irony, isn't it?
Totally.
I mean, Pilate recognizes Jesus's innocence.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have the courage to stand against, you know, the will of the crowd and the authorities.
Right, right. And so as Jesus is being led away to be crucified, we're introduced to Simon of Cyrene.
Right.
And Simon is coming in from the countryside.
Right. He's coming from the country.
Yeah. And the Roman soldiers force him to carry Jesus's cross.
Yeah. And the lecture pointed out that Simon's actually from North Africa originally.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he's part of the Jewish diaspora.
Oh, wow.
So it brings this kind of unexpected figure into this pivotal moment. Someone from outside the immediate kind of Jerusalem context.
Right.
And it reminds us that this event had implications that extended far beyond just that local context.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then we also have the women who follow Jesus.
Yes.
Who are weeping and lamenting his fate.
Yeah.
And Jesus even turns to them and offers them some comfort.
I know, and he even gives a prophecy
about
the difficult times that are ahead for Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's just like, even in the midst of his own suffering, he's still thinking about others.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
It's remarkable.
So then at the place that is called the skull.
Right.
Which Luke just translates, you know, he doesn't use the Aramaic Golgotha. Jesus is crucified.
Yes.
Alongside two criminals.
Right.
And it's there that he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Such a powerful prayer.
I know.
Spoken at the worst possible moment.
Yeah. And Luke also mentions, you know, the soldiers casting lots for his clothing.
Right.
And the people watching.
Yes.
And the rulers and the soldiers continue to mock him.
Yeah. They're challenging him to save himself.
Yeah. If he really is the Messiah.
Right.
If he's the chosen one, the King of the Jews.
Right.
And then you have this really interesting interaction between Jesus and the two criminals.
Right.
Who are crucified next to him.
One of them joins in the mocking, but the other rebukes him and says, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.
Right. And Jesus replies, truly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise.
Right.
And the lecturer was talking about how paradise in this context,
yes,
you know, doesn't mean like, you know, a tropical island or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. No, no. It's not a vacation destination.
Right. It means like a state of being and perhaps presence, you know.
Heavenly bliss.
Yes. And there was also that funny moment where he's like,
oh, yeah.
And it doesn't mean tomato.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently in some Slavic languages.
I know. It was funny.
Tomato is like a similar word or something.
Yeah, yeah. It was a good one.
But the point is, it's about being with God right after death.
Yeah, yeah. And then we have that moment where darkness descends.
Yes.
And the temple curtain is torn in two.
Such symbolic events.
Yeah.
You know, the darkness suggests some kind of cosmic disruption, right? Mm. Divine judgment.
Yeah.
Mourning. And then that tearing of the temple curtain.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, there are so many interpretations, right?
Right.
Some people see it as, you know, a symbol of the temple's eventual destruction.
Right.
Some see it as the end of the old covenant, you know, and the beginning of a new relationship between God and humanity. And then some people see it as, you know, this removal of a barrier that now allows for direct access to God for all people, Jew and Gentile alike.
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, it's a powerful image.
Yeah, that's good. So, Jesus' last words are, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.
Powerful.
And then he dies.
And it's interesting because Luke omits those Aramaic phrases and the detail about the wine mixed with myrrh that we see in some of the other gospels.
Yeah.
So his focus seems to be really on portraying Jesus' death as this peaceful act of surrender and trust in God.
Okay. And he also emphasizes, you know, the eyewitnesses.
Yes, it does.
The crowd, the rulers, the soldiers, the women who had followed him from Galilee.
Yeah.
And that Roman centurion declares that Jesus is innocent.
Right.
And then the crowd is like beating their breasts in sorrow.
They're recognizing what's happened.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So then we have Joseph of Arimathea.
Yes.
Who's a member of the Sanhedrin.
Right.
But he didn't agree with the decision to condemn Jesus.
Yeah. And Luke describes him as a good and righteous man.
Yeah. A follower of Jesus who is waiting for the kingdom of God.
And it's interesting because unlike some of the other gospels where he's portrayed as like a secret disciple, Luke's presenting him as more openly devout.
Right.
So he goes to Pilate and requests Jesus's body.
Right.
He wraps it in a linen shroud and lays it in a new tomb.
Yeah. The lecturer was talking about that too, about how significant that is.
Hugely significant.
You know, like this proper burial.
Yes.
A new tomb.
Right.
I mean, that's not what usually happened to people who were crucified.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Their bodies were often just thrown into mass graves.
Right. Right.
So this signifies respect, honor.
Yeah.
And Luke is very clear that Jesus is the first person to be laid in this tomb.
Right.
And then the women observe the burial.
Right.
And they intend to return later to anoint the body.
Right.
With spices and ointments.
Yeah. So as we kind of wrap up here, Luke's account just really drives home this point about Jesus's innocence, right? Like he's repeatedly declared innocent.
By Pilate, by Herod, even by the penitent thief who's hanging next to him.
Right.
And yet he endures this unimaginable suffering.
Right. And even through all of that, he shows compassion and forgiveness.
He does.
And then, you know, finally he receives this dignified burial.
Yeah. Luke's narrative really emphasizes the injustice of Jesus's condemnation and that pivotal role of the leaders in his death.
Mm-hmm.
And it really highlights the magnitude of his sacrifice.
Yeah. So this whole journey that we've been on together, you know, into Luke's perspective on this has just brought so much to light, you know, Peter's denial and his remorse. Yeah. The mocking, the political stuff with the leaders, the declarations of innocence, the compassion, the burial.
Yeah, it really lays bare the core of the Christian gospel, right?
Yeah.
It's innocent suffering and death of Jesus.
Yeah. And so as we kind of leave our listeners to think about all this, I'm just really curious, like, what part of this story resonates most with you?
Yeah, what detail, what moment, you know, in all of this really kind of stands out to you.
Yeah. And why?
And what does it reveal to you about Jesus's character?
Yeah.
His mission. And ultimately, what does it mean for you?
Yeah. So take some time to think about that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you next time.
See you then.